You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Isabel Fonseca's debut novel, Attachment, is the story of a middle-aged woman who opens her husband's mail and finds an explicitly sexual letter containing an email address with an access code. The book received great reviews when it was released in hardcover last year. Vogue described it as fearless, and Faye Weldon called it gratifyingly readable. It's just been released as a vintage trade paperback, and I'm very pleased that it brings Isabel Fonseca back to our show. Welcome.
Hi, nice to be here again.
I should point out that the last time you were here was over a dozen years ago, wasn't it, for
yeah.
Bury Me Standing, your book about gypsies?
That's right.
And that was quite a success. At that time, did you think of yourself as a writer of nonfiction?
I barely thought of myself as a writer. I mean, I had that one great adventure that I wanted to explore and share, and I wrote this book that turned out to have a long life.
Being reissued now, isn't it?
It's being reissued, and it was published in 20 countries, and it's generated other forms. I mean, there are ballets and films that take the title of that book, Bury Me Standing, so that's a form of flattery like no other.
Well, have you been keeping up with what's happening with the Roma population across Europe? Because we've talked about some of the serious problems that are happening in Italy and Hungary and elsewhere
yes.
last week on our underreported series.
That's right. I mean, I when I got to update the book a little bit, I was sad to discover that, in fact, things had not improved. On the contrary, things are harder, if anything. And one difference is that the sort of mob violence that was a hallmark in Romania is now happening in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just written about a terrible case in northern Kosovo where a large group, 8,000 displaced gypsies during the 1999 upheavals, were sort of forced out by some ethnic Albanians because they're seen as collaborators with the Serbs. And they always occupy this curious place of being seen as collaborators with the enemy, whoever the enemy may be. But the
because they're always the other.
They're always the other. In this case, the UN established a refugee camp. However, it was located on a well-known to be contaminated site, an ex-lead mine. And they've been there for 10 years, despite noise being made by all sorts of bodies. And so a whole generation of people born there have been born with brain damage. And anyway, Human Rights Watch has a report on this case coming out next week, so I just wanted to get that in there.
Well, you said that you were a surprise writer, but did you do it kind of out of self-defense? After all, you're married to Martin Amis, and he goes off every day, I'm sure, to write. It seems reasonable that you might say, well, okay, I'll go off every day and write as well.
Well, I wasn't married to Martin Amis back then when I wrote my first book. But it's not a bad thing sharing the building with one of our best prose writers. It has its hidden joys.
I don't know whether some couples actually show each other their work and others will do anything but.
Well, I think all writers are incredibly insecure, and I'm certainly one of those kinds of writers. So I don't show him my stuff until I'm really done. I mean, I'm far too likely to be influenced by what he thinks, one way or the other.
So there you are. You wrote that book, Bury Me Standing, and did you think, I want to write fiction? Because here we are a dozen years later or so, and we have a work of fiction.
I didn't think I want to write fiction. I think that is, you know, writers on the whole don't choose what they're going to write. It sort of chooses you. And I have this idea that all writing investigates some anxiety and, you know, might be a public one or an existential one. In the case of the Gypsy book, it was very much that. I mean, starting out as an investigation about whether or not gypsies would be a kind of litmus test of the new democracies in Václav Havel's phrase. And then it became more existential as I got to know them. You know, what does it mean to be a people? You know, how do we recognize a group that have nothing, no flag, no anthem, no homeland, no desire for homeland, and yet we all know what they are, and they're alive in our imagination. And then, you know, maybe fiction is more an investigation of a kind of silent anxiety. Whatever it is, something's nagging at you, and it kind of fights its way to the front until you give it your full attention.
Well, there are no gypsies in this book. It begins with Jean opening a letter addressed to her husband, which some people would see as an invasion of privacy. What makes her want to open it? Does she have reason to be suspicious?
No, she's so relaxed and unsuspicious that it doesn't occur to her to open, to not open. It's that they get so little mail. And
because they're living in a very remote
place. And she just opens it for no reason. It's a real letter instead of a junk mail flyer.
Well, in the long history of literature, has anything good ever come out of that particular action?
Well, it is certainly the violent precipitant where something comes at you from outside and forces you to look inside is a long-standing, trusty, fictional device. Maybe what's different about this case is that she chooses to answer the letter as if she were him. And so I had this little feeling about an exploration of personal identity and how that changes in the context of a long marriage, that sort of thing.
Well, why wouldn't she confront him at once?
Well, it is consistent with her character. I mean, she's a columnist who has a large number of relationships with readers. You know,
she's a health columnist.
She's a health columnist. But, I mean, she's at ease with these virtual relationships, as more and more people are, as we all are. I mean, that's email, this sort of replacement relationships, this sort of ease with the virtual is something I also explore a lot in this book. So she's used to kind of investigating. She's a journalist, and is not interested in the moral high ground. She's not interested in a confrontation. She wants to know who he is. You know, she's got this whole new idea of her closest friend, her most intimate sharer, and it seems that it's not what she thought. And so as a journalist, as a wife, as a shy person, she just wants to know.
But also, as somebody who writes a column, she's an expert of sorts, although that doesn't mean that that makes her expert in dealing with the complications of her
own
life. Not at all.
She's misdiagnosed this particular pathology.
In the case of writers, they're often imagining there's someone else, so this might be something she would fall into. She comes up early with a question that I think is central to the book. Why should someone believe she's entitled to happiness?
Well, you know, this book has a kind of adultery plot, but it investigates a particular moment that maybe comes to us all at a certain age when things shift and the relationship with a husband shifts, where the parents are suddenly older, a child is coming of age. So, you know, there's a shift in the balance of care and responsibility. And I think in many marriages, you know, maybe all, if you stick around long enough, there is this sort of moment of questioning, and this is such a moment where there's a kind of involuntary chaos, and you are sometimes afforded some special clarity, and this is where she finds herself.
But do you think that even in this post-feminist age, women still believe that they'll achieve happiness through marriage?
Well, I think it is part of the assumption of marriage, that you get together and you have this merger. And I think for women particularly, you tend to get submerged possibly a bit more, generally through children. And then the children grow up, and you have to sort of reconnect with your original trajectory. But the unspoken deal is that in exchange for all this, I'm secure, I'm happy, I'm protected from event. And, you know, you either sort of... I mean, it's a great liberation to recover responsibility for your own happiness, but it is a shift when you've gone into a merger. And, you know, many people literally sort of losing their names, or in this case, her name, her country, her career.
There's also the temptation to blame. Speaking of feminism, Jean is almost reflexively blames Mark's mother, as if not teaching him to pick up after himself ultimately led to an affair.
Well, it's a first impulse to blame your mother-in-law. It's like a sort of classic line, but she doesn't stay there very long.
But at one point she...
In fact, she blames herself a lot, doesn't she? I mean, she creates a whole universe of self-reproach as if it's her fault, which is...
And then she asks herself if she would forgive her daughter any transgression, and then wonders whether that shouldn't be true for her husband as well.
And indeed for herself. I mean, one of the things that we don't know for a long time is her husband really having an affair or not? It's not entirely clear, but she bounds ahead on the information, sort of flaky information she has. And it can be seen to be a kind of elaborate construction of seeking permission for her own temporary liberation or investigation of, you know, her own desires in that department. But
well, her reaction is almost entirely cerebral. It's different from, for example, the reaction her mother has in a restaurant 20 years after her husband's infidelity.
Yes, there's a scene in the book where she discovers her parents have been through this, and it wasn't known at the time, and her mother is still rankling from the kind of humiliation of a sexual betrayal. And they say you can't write about sex because it's one thing that is not universal. It's particular, it's peculiar. But there are elements of it that certainly are universal, and humiliation and the comedy of humiliation is a rich field. But so she has that precedent and doesn't want to find herself at her mother's age still imploding with that sense of humiliation.
My guess is Isabel Fonseca, her novel Attachment, has just been released as a vintage trade paperback. And here comes the inevitable, how autobiographical is it question. Jean Hubbard is an American who's been married to Mark, a very successful Brit. They're living in a remote tropical island as a kind of sabbatical, and you and Martin Amis lived in Uruguay for several years. There's a character who believes herself to be Mark's illegitimate daughter, and we read in the newspapers about Martin Amis's discovery that he had a grown-up daughter. So were you concerned that people would assume this book is based on certain aspects of your life?
I wasn't concerned what anyone thought. I mean, I think you would never write if you were concerned about an anticipated reaction. You would just seek the fetal position under the nearest sofa. But I certainly didn't dodge that whole possibility. And I think, you know, you do, as a writer, plunder episodes from your life. Some of them were unconscious. For example, the one about the ambiguous paternity of the daughter. I never connected to my wonderful stepdaughter, Delilah. But that has been pointed out to me. So part of it is subconscious, the stuff you use. But it's a big mistake as a reader, I think, to look for these parallels. It's also, you know, it's a dull way to experience literature. But yes, there are things you write about what you're interested in. I'm not a science fiction writer, but nor is it a journalistic account, and it's not a report. I mean, I think it's Philip Roth who says that you don't write what happened, you write what didn't happen. And the job of a novelist in particular is to explore the what-ifs. So what if this letter came? What would you do? How would you react? And, you know, it's one of the joys of being a writer is that you can work these things out on paper. You don't have to act them out and suffer the consequences.
Several times in the book, Jean refers to a Philip Larkin poem that ends with the line, "What will survive of us is love." Now, Philip Larkin is one of those problematic poets because he's both the great poet and an awful person, but I don't know if that was a consideration when you were thinking about him, except that pornography also comes up and his fascination with pornography.
Well, that is a kind of unintended link about the pornography. I don't know if he was an awful person. He was a person of his time and the prejudices of his time.
There were people with fewer prejudices in England at the time that Philip Larkin lived.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a whole other discussion, but he was a wonderful poet who's given us a lot to chew on since then. I think that poem in particular, "What Will Survive of Us Is Love," I mean, this is one of the dilemmas. This has come to this woman, and people say, well, why doesn't she just confront him, you know? Why isn't it more a feminist, you know? Why didn't she just clobber him? Well, the thing is, she loves him, and so this is it. What we would do in such a situation, we don't know until we're in it. But love is a powerful thing, and it's surprising to your. I have to tell your listeners this. I guess I don't, but
it's a powerful.
What?
Don't reveal how it.
No, I won't.
Works out.
I won't. But I think that how we react and how we're prepared to forgive, to feel, to investigate is, you know, is bent by love.
But there's also that question always: is it possible, even in a long marriage, to truly understand the other person?
Well, is it possible? I mean, how far does empathy take us? And there is this, I thought of it as a kind of circle where you're in the middle and the other person's around you, and there's this sort of murky penumbra in between of the shared self. And, you know, how how do each of us experience common events? You know, is it the same? I mean, the difference is, of course, the sort of basis of farce. You know, how people misapprehend situations, and there's a bit of that farce in this book. But that's what a marriage is, that sort of murky area. Where do we come together, and how much common? I mean, the chances of a sort of development with any real synchronicity over 20, 30 years is sort of laughable proposition, and yet we all long to sign on for it, or many of us do. And it's an endlessly interesting subject to live and to write about and to think about.
So what's next, nonfiction or fiction?
Fiction, and a complicated, very different sort of book, but I'm about a third of the way in. Can't say more.
Attachment, which obviously refers to something that happens with email, but also refers to things that happen in family and in marriages, is the title of Isabel Fonseca's novel, her first novel, which is now being released in a vintage trade paperback. Thank you so much for being with
us. Thanks for having me.
Up next, your calls to Patricia T. O'Connor, our word maven about the English language. Our phone number is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.